morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, Linda Siegel is going to be with us with the legislative wrap-up. Right now, I would like to welcome, joining us by phone, Casey Biggs of the Acting Company, a New York theater group that will be performing this Friday, February 22nd, at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you. Now, you are directing a play by Orson Welles called Moby Dick Rehearsed, and I think probably even fans of Orson Welles may not be familiar with this piece of theater. Tell us about it.
Well, Welles, in his own inimitable style in 1955, adapted Moby Dick for himself, and he performed it in London. He actually never performed it in New York, but it was produced there in 1962. And the fascinating thing for me, directing for the Acting Company and actually having gone to the Juilliard School where John Houseman was the head of the school and then subsequently created the Acting Company where many great actors have come out of, he was Orson Welles' producer for most of his early famous life. So it seems very interesting to me that here I am in 2008, coming full circle, having been mentored by John Houseman, directing a play that Orson Welles developed for himself about probably one of the greatest stories of our time, you know, the great white whale, being chased by the great white whale, Melville's tale. Right. And we had a great time. We rehearsed it in New York City in November, and it's been out on the road for a few weeks now, and it will travel to about 40 cities before it ends up back in New York City playing in New York.
I was reading on the net that apparently there was a film made of this by Orson Welles, but it was lost. What do you know about that?
Well, there's some very little. If you go on, you can. I checked it out, actually, too. You can go on and you can find little snippets of Welles, basically in his stentorian style, reading passages from the book. But that's about all that has been left about it. They did film it. I think they filmed it, and they actually showed it on television in London at the time, but it's never been shown any other time that I know of it, actually.
Right. Why is it called Moby Dick Rehearsed? Set up the play for us.
Well, Orson Welles very cleverly bookended the epic story of Moby Dick between a rehearsal of a 19th century theater company that has come in to do a pickup rehearsal of King Lear that the company is rehearsing. And a young member of the cast brings in this new book, Moby Dick, and says this thing has to be heard, not just read. So the company decides to perform it, basically. And so it's bookended by this conceit. And then before we know it, and sort of the way that I've directed it as well, before we know it, we are in the middle of this gigantic story. And the entire company and hopefully the entire audience is moved, strangely moved by the end of the piece. Their lives have been changed in some way. And it was interesting to me, because I stuck something in at the end of the play, that one of the reasons I wanted to do this piece is because I feel that we, as a society, not only society, but as a world village, will basically never stop being chased by this great white whale. And that's one of the things that intrigued me about it.
It is interesting, I have to say. I was kind of thinking about the contrast between the symbolism of the whale in the 19th century, where it's, you know, represents powerful, untamed nature and so on, and our situation today, where man is way more of a threat to the whale than the whale is to the human being. I mean, I'm sure that Orson Welles wasn't thinking about that, but how do you think about it in a 21st century context?
Well, it's a very interesting thing because it resonates on so many different levels. I mean, it goes much deeper metaphorically than that too. I mean, because it's about the nature of good and evil, and it's about the nature of God and man, and it's about the nature of, it's sort of in a very interesting way, a philosophical history of the people of the United States in terms of their individualism, it's very interesting. I didn't really put this into the piece, but when I was researching it, I found an article that talks about Bush and Al-Qaeda and Melville's story in White Whale, and basically who's the whale and who's Ahab and who's chasing who and who wins in the end and who takes down the ship in spite of anything because of their what they have gone through and their revenge. And I was really intrigued by that notion, which sort of brought me around to that, again, you know, we will never be rid of this need for either whether it's revenge or power or who's right and who's you know, might makes right. And in the end, the whale is a little stronger than the ship. But it is. I mean, the reason it makes Melville's story so universal and so such a classic is that it reverberates on so many, many, many different levels. I mean, it's a brilliant piece. I mean, most people, they go, oh, my God, I have to read Moby Dick, a 600-page novel. But, my God, it's an extraordinary piece of writing.
Well, and as a philosophical history of the U.S., it's a cautionary tale, shall we say, at best.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, here we are reading Moby Dick, and at the end, the only person left is the narrator.
Right, and Wells, beautifully. I mean, it's not a long piece. I think, you know, the evening is under 2 hours. My production, and what I love about it is that it you feel like you've been through this epic, and you've been through something, and you are emotionally engaged, and through sheer theatricality. I mean, the reason Wells is very smart too is that, I mean, I think we do this piece with a few ladders and some touring boxes. I mean, that's what it sort of looks like. It's of course much more complicated than that. And what I consciously did, because I thought about plays. Some people have done this production where they place it in modern day clothes and all that. What I really, really, really wanted to do was to set the piece. It's a period piece in the 19th century, clothing, all the rest. So the audience is a little distance from it because, oh, this is a period piece, I can sit back. And then all of a sudden you're grabbed by the neck and thrown onto the ship and into the water with the rest of the crew and the whale. And there's sort of a, I teach directing at the New School in New York as well, and I find myself sort of pounding into the head of these young directors a concept which is based on unity, universe, and spirit. And when we talk about a work of art, whether it be a piece of theater or a piece of music or painting or architecture even, it has to contain all of those elements, unity being the harmony among the component parts, universe, the piece has to reveal universe and spirit. It has to have that moment where you go, aha, and you're lifted up and out of the morass, so to speak. And I think that I sort of achieved that with this piece, and I'm would be very interested to see hear what the audience in Santa Fe has to, how their reaction is to it. So,
we're talking to Casey Biggs of the Acting Company, who will be performing Moby Dick Rehearsed this Friday at the Lenzic, Friday, February 22nd. Tell us more about the King Lear theme in this piece.
Well, he uses that again very, very cleverly and in a comic way, actually. Because you have, you know, the piece, it starts out, you see the company sitting around waiting for the actor-manager, who Wells, based after himself, just comes in, and he runs, they had a bad run-through of the show the previous night, and he wanted to work on a few pieces, so I threw in a lot of comic bits in that way, and then they're all sort of surprised they're not going to go on with the rehearsal when the actor-manager says, no, we're going to try the new piece today. And he sets the scene for us, and boom, we're right into it. I'm not going to give too much away about how it gets into the story. But the first act, I sort of deal much more naturalistically, and the second act much more expressionistically, which I think that the novel does as well. And then at the end, you know, he just, like, with one or two lines, he brings us back to the theater company, and you can visibly see how it has affected those who have actually committed themselves to telling the story, which I think is a magnificent thing that theater does that film or television can't do, actually. I watched the old movie, the John Huston film, a couple of times, too, and I had forgotten sort of how it's really powerful, but it's a little corny in its way as well. And then you have Orson Welles, you know, doing a cameo in the film itself.
Tell us more about this concept of what theater can do that film cannot.
Well, film and television is, and I have done a lot of it myself, is a passive engagement. I mean, the piece itself will be there whether you're watching it or not. Theater doesn't happen unless there's an intercourse between the audience and the player and the performer and the stage. And one of the reasons I still commit myself to doing is because I truly believe that it can change you. You will walk out differently than you walk into it, into the theater. And that's why, I mean, let's face it, true theater artists really don't make a whole heck of a lot of money. I mean, you do it because you have to do it. And when you see a production or a play or a performance that changes you, that affects you in a way, I mean, I can remember productions and performances to this day. I can see moments. And it affects how I live my life. And I think that the artists in our society are the shamans of our society. I mean, which, being in Santa Fe, you know, they're pretty connected with their metaphysics. And I truly believe that we, as artists, are shamans of our society, and our job is to hold that mirror up to nature and say, see, this is who you are. This is who we are. So that's how I think it affects. Some movies do that. Most television doesn't.
Right. That's for sure. Just out of curiosity, when you say that there's some theater pieces you can still remember that you think about that change your life, what were they?
Oh, my goodness. Sunday in the Park with George, Stephen Sondheim's a great musical, was seminal in the early 80s. There's a performance of The Seagull that I saw in the West End in London with Vanessa Redgrave, just magnificent. It's interesting because I'm commuting right now between California and New York to teach, and I had to go to the New School where I teach to see some performances by the MFA students. And I'll be damned if there isn't two or three moments I saw in these productions of one act that I will remember for the rest of my life. So it's little things like that. And you know, you gather those things. And as a director, you know, I worked with a brilliant director named Liviu Chule one time, who's actually director for the acting company as well. And he says that he says his direction sticks to his pants like burrs, because as he moves through the world, he collects all of these little moments and these things. And there again, there was another production that he did of another Chekhov, actually, Three Sisters, that it was definitive. And if I ever do it, I'm going to steal every single thing I can from that production.
That's interesting. I mean, how do you create your style as a director? And since you've worked in so many different genres, including film and TV and theater and so on, what is it that you're specifically collecting when you're learning how to direct? And I mean, you've perfected your craft as an actor, but also as a director.
Well, that's a very, very interesting question, because style is a result of something. I mean, you can't play style. You can't say, okay, we're going to do this we're going to do it in this style. Style comes from a need to do something. Now, if you think it like, you know, restoration, you talk about what I do. I consider myself a classicist. I love really, really big stories. Really, I mean, that's why Shakespeare fascinates me so much, and the Greeks and restoration. But then to take that and move it into a Tennessee Williams, let's say, or something like that. All that does is strengthen the foundation with what you do with your storytelling abilities. Now, I love Peter Brook, who was a great English theater artist, wrote a book called The Empty Space. But to me, there is nothing more interesting than an empty space, an actor, and really great text, which is basically how I do, how Moby Dick looks. It's not how I did it, but it's how it looks. And that, to me, is along with a very musical sensibility. I direct in a very musical way. I think of it as a score. I'm writing a score visually, orally, physically. Everything that I do in terms of from the movement to the sound to this, I think of it as a piece of music, so that when the actors come to it, they can play to a greater or lesser degree of brilliance the same piece of music every night. And that's what the rehearsal process is all about. You've got to write this score, this piece of music, in terms of emotional landscape, visual landscape, which is very interesting, because when a lay person, the audience who the piece is directed for, will come and watch it, and they're really not terribly, they're not supposed to be able to see all of those elements, but it's a real craft, and that's why I find it fascinating to teach the craft as well, because I have been very, very lucky to learn from. I mean, I've stood on the shoulders of giants, I feel, in the directors that I've learned from and been directed by. Now, that's sort of a long-winded answer to your question, but it's a big question.
Yeah. So the Moby Dick rehearsed, it's not going to be full of boats and masts and harpoons and papier-mâché whales.
But you will think you have seen them all.
Very interesting.
You will feel that you have seen that whale and that ship and those harpoons and those people and that water. I mean, I think you will. But no, there aren't. We don't use papier-mâché whales, no.
So going back just for a moment to the King Lear and Moby Dick thing, I mean, two great tragedies, one of them American, you know, one of them obviously Shakespearean tragedy. Is there any parallel between them? I was thinking about King Lear, and it seems like such a different, I mean, I don't think there's a woman in all of Moby Dick, whereas King Lear revolves around these three daughters.
Well, what Wells, again, very deftly did is he took one of the great tragedies of a man's choice. You look at King Lear's choice, what he did and what it did to his life. I mean, he gave away his kingdom to the wrong daughters and subsequently destroyed his life and took everything down with him. And then you have Ahab, who is, you know, as big a character as Lear is, and as stubborn and as outrageous, and he does the same thing. And Wells beautifully did to him. You've got the Cordelia, and you see a little piece of the Cordelia and King Lear scene in the beginning. And then, because there's only one woman in Moby Dick, there are no women in Moby Dick. He takes that the woman in the company and says, "Okay, you're playing the young black boy, because we don't have a young black boy." And then we see some beautiful scenes that mirror the Cordelia or the Fool scenes from King Lear, the King and the Fool. And then you have Ahab and Pip, who is the young black cabin boy, who is played by a young white woman. And so we see the parallel of these two scenes. And then it's incredibly moving, because the only person King Lear really related to was the Fool. If you know the play at all, I mean,
right.
The fool, that the only man who speaks truth to power is the fool. God forbid we would have one in our day today. But and then we have the same with the young black boy and Ahab.
So you have on stage people playing multiple roles?
Oh, my goodness, yes, they play. It's an incredibly talented ensemble that plays a plethora of roles.
What do you do? Do you do anything mechanically so that people who are watching who maybe don't know the story that well know what character each person is in? I mean, do they change their shoes or something?
It's a very subtle thing as well. I mean, it's designed to sort of look like a rehearsal that becomes a full-blown production. So it's subtly, we see the 19th century silhouette. The costume designer, Jared Oswegan, did a brilliant, brilliant job of taking these 19th century clothes and then all of a sudden subtly moving them through. I like the young woman who's in the King Lear cast. She comes back, you know, with the, you know, cut off pants and the rest of that. So yes, we know we took the silhouettes and made them very real to the time period. And then there is another woman in the cast who plays a man, because we needed, the show is, the company is touring two shows, The Tempest and King Lear. I mean, not King Lear, Moby Dick. And so they needed two women in The Tempest. So I said, well, great, let's get a woman. But she's going to play a man throughout the entire thing. So she starts as a woman and then, you know, she switches to a man, which is nobody even questions it. It's a beautiful way to do it. And yes, you there are costume changes that let you know who's doing what, you know, because we have a number of sailors. Some are distinctive and some aren't. And then there, of course, there's Queequeg, you know, they remember the aboriginal harpooner and all of that, and so you will see Queequeg's tattoos, let's say.
We're talking to Casey Biggs of the Acting Company. Tell us more about the Acting Company.
The Acting Company is when I got out of Juilliard in 1977, there were, I believe, about 12 resident theater companies in the United States. Literally now, there is one or two. That's how it's changed. And the acting company being one of them. The Acting Company is 35 years old this year, actually. John Houseman started the theater department at the Juilliard School in 1968. And that class of, I think there were 15 people in that class, was so talented, he didn't want them to split up. So he created a theater company from that class of actors that had gone through the school. And in that class of actors was Patti LuPone, Kevin Kline, David Ogden Stein. I mean, people who have gone on to have amazing careers. Now, it's pretty amazing and miraculous that a company has lasted 35 years to begin with. And a company like this, which is dedicated to taking relatively young theater artists, professionals, and putting them in repertories that are challenging and sending them, it's basically a national theater company. I mean, we have played, I forget what it says, but I mean hundreds and hundreds of cities and like 300 productions all around the United States and Europe as well. And when I was in the company, we had three shows with brilliant directors and a great sets and casts, and played everywhere from Walla Walla, Washington to Palm Beach, Florida, and every place in between, including Chicago and New York and Los Angeles. So it is an experience for a young actor unlike anything else they can get in the United States today.
What's happened to all the residential theater companies?
Money. They don't have the money to keep the companies going. So what they do is they. I was at the Arena Stage, which was the mother of all regional theaters in the United States for about 10 years. And we had a company of about 18 to 20 people. And we were on contract for 9-10 months a year. So you really felt you had a home there. Well, people can't afford to do that anymore. I mean, the theaters just cannot afford. For one thing, you know, they aren't really supported by the government all that much as they are in the rest of the world. And corporate giving has changed. And so what they do, they've gone down to smaller shows, 2-3 people, 4 people. I mean, if you travel and you see theater around the country, that's basically what it is. And if there's something like at Lincoln Center in New York City this year, they did Tom Stoppard's new play that had 40 people in it, but they got an enormous amount of subsidy to do something like that. So it's all a money issue.
And as that money has dried up, has the quality, I mean, the amount of theater is less, and these residential theater companies are fewer, but has the quality of theater also gone down, or does the artistic spirit prevail anyway?
Well, I think the spirit prevails, but and the quality is still the same, but they cannot really be as what can I say, bold, or as take as many chances, or do. I mean, instead of doing like the Tom Stoppard play where they had 40 people and it was about the entire Russian history of Turgenev and all of the writers there, they can do maybe one of those every 10 years and not have that wonderful meal of in a theater or in a community where you can see Shakespeare or Chekhov or brand new productions or something that makes real scope and has that kind of effect, because they can't afford to do it. I mean, and it's a very, very interesting thing. You think about writers now. Writers are not writing like that. They're writing 2-character pieces, 3-character pieces, because they know they will not be produced if it's too expensive to produce. And it's a sea change that has happened, and you can sort of see it move through time. Because before, people were writing, I mean, you think about the great writers of the 30s and 40s and Odets and all those people. They had full, huge, juicy casts. Now you look at what's being written and what's being produced even in New York today or anywhere else. It's, you know, you got 2 characters. three characters. How many one-person shows have you seen? Or how many one-person shows have come through? It's so cheap. They're not, they don't get those great big traditional acting companies coming around anymore. Even the company I'm working with now, we have 11 people. I wanted 14. They couldn't afford 14. I had to figure out how to do it with 11. And we did. When I was in the company in the 80s, we had, I believe, 16 to 18 actors on the road. They just can't.
And all,
afford to do it.
And all of this, although you can't measure it, ultimately has an effect on the artistic soul of our society.
Oh, boy, you hit that on the head. I mean, it's mirrored in our political scene and our cultural scene, excuse me, in our educational scene. And I live in New York State on the Hudson Valley, and the arts education has been decimated up there, decimated. You cannot learn to play a trumpet. You can't learn to dance. You can't learn, and looking at a society that doesn't cherish its cultural sensibility and also ultimately know what it's going to do to the culture 20, 30 years from now is pretty frightening to me. Anyway.
And on that note, unfortunately, we have to go. But if people would like to take refuge in what's left of theater in Santa Fe, we do have quite a theater scene here in Santa Fe.
I know. And I tell you, that theater that the company's playing in, I love Santa Fe. I wish I was sitting next to you right now, because my wife and I go to Santa Fe every year. I just love it, love it, love it. And that theater is a beautiful little gem, I think.
Well, we look forward to seeing you. Casey Biggs is with the Acting Company in New York Theater Group. They will be performing Moby Dick Rehearsed this Friday, February 22nd, at the Lenzig Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe. And the number for tickets there is 988-1234. Casey Biggs, thanks so much for spending all this time with us.
My pleasure. And you won't be disappointed, I don't think.
Excellent. We're going to take a little break right now, and Linda Siegel will be joining us in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Are Mexicans who risk their lives to come to America dangerous criminals, or families searching for a better life? Is the immigration debate fated to be awash with political posturing, or can the deeper truths laid out on our borders be told? Join Alfredo Corchado, Mexico bureau chief of the Dallas Morning News and World Press Photo award-winning border photographer Eric Schlegel, on Friday, February 22nd at 7 p.m. as they go behind the politics in Hard News, Soft Dreams, a journalistic walk across borders. This message is sponsored by CSF.
The colors of jazz. Diverse, eclectic, surprising. Only on KSFR, Mondays, 9 a.m. to noon.
I'd like now to welcome Linda Siegel, KSFR's legislative correspondent, who has very kindly been joining us on Tuesdays and Thursdays throughout the legislative session. And we are now here to do the legislative wrap-up.
Good morning, Mayor Charlotte.
Good morning. Great to have you here. Now, this is a 30-day session, which means that it really wasn't about passing all sorts of legislation. And some legislation's about the budget, and we do have a budget at this point. And we also did pass some bills. First of all, what did pass? Do you want to start talking about the budget?
Sure. The most important thing in a 30-day session is the budget. That's what the Constitution says that the legislature should do. And so this year, we got used to, over the last few years, of having lots of extra money. Like last year, we had over $600 million in recurring dollars, and the year before that, about the same. And this year, the revenues really went down. So we only had about 360 new recurring dollars, and when you get used to that that higher number, it makes it a little more difficult to do a budget. But the legislature did pass a budget. That's House Bill 2, and it's over $6 billion, which 10 years ago we were looking at a $4.3 billion budget. So over the years, it's really been growing. And that bill went to the governor long before the session ended, so that he had time to line item veto some things. And he vetoed about $16 million worth of projects, which is not very much in a $6 billion budget.
What kind of thing got vetoed? Anything of note?
Well, child care rate increases got line item vetoed, and developmentally disabled nonprofit rate increases got vetoed. He line item vetoed some smaller things, and so total it was about the $16 billion. So it's not, it was certainly significant to those groups that got vetoed, but not huge. And in addition to House Bill 2, we have what's called House Bill 2 Junior, and the legislature does that every year, and that was a Senate bill. What it does is lets each chamber, the House and the Senate and the governor, actually put in little projects that they want. And that bill totaled about $21 million. Each chamber got $7 million. Last year, that was a $45 million bill where everybody got $15 million. So that also went to the governor before the session ended, and he line item vetoed a few things in that, but nothing too significant. So those two bills are done.
Excellent.
Now, what's not?
That means they've done their work.
Yes, they think, well, except for the capital outlay bill.
Uh-huh.
And as you might remember, they did send the capital outlay bill up to the governor before the last 3 days of the session, and he vetoed the entire bill. That's about a $348 million
project. Why? What was the rationale?
Well, he said that it didn't give him time to review all the 2,000 projects that are in the bill. And, of course, these are huge bills with every legislator, all 112 legislators, getting to decide what they want to do with their little pot of money. Every legislator gets a little pot. The House gets a smaller pot than the Senate. And, of course, the governor gets a pot of money. And normally that bill doesn't go up until the last 3 days. And if it goes up in the last 3 days, it means the governor has 20 days to line item veto or sign it. And of course, last year he hardly vetoed anything in that capital outlay bill. But this year he said, well, you got it to me too early. I haven't had time to review it, and I'm going to veto the whole thing.
Too early? Too late?
Got it to him too early. Well, too early, because then he has 3 days to deal with it, and he wants the 20 days to deal with the capital outlay. So he vetoed the entire bill.
Now, so then what happened?
Well, fortunately, there were two bills going, one in the House, one in the Senate, and it was the House bill that went to the governor. So they just took the Senate bill, which was just about the same. There were a couple differences in it, and sent the Senate bill up to him. So now he's got a new capital outlay bill, and will have his 20 days to review each of the line items. And, of course, that's what people are saying is being held hostage for the special session.
Mm-hmm.
Because the governor was not happy that his health care bill, did not pass in the session.
So what it looks like is, I might just sign this if you guys pass health care?
Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like. In fact, the Albuquerque Journal had a great Trevor cartoon on Sunday that showed the governor holding this big pig with a .45 pointed at the pig and a police officer, somebody off in the distance, going, hostage situation.
You don't get your pork.
Right, right. So we'll have to see. If the governor's going to use the capital outlay as a stick to bring the legislators back, then he has to have the special session before March 5th. And if not, then that won't be something that impacts them, the vetoes of that bill.
Okay. Now, let's say capital outlay just got vetoed outright completely. Then lots of people will be without their little projects.
Yeah, and remember, most of these are really important projects. They're water wells, they're community centers, they're vans for senior centers, they're expanding museums, they're supporting nonprofits that do much of the health and social services in New Mexico. So we call it pork, but it really is essential to the health and welfare and culture even of people in New Mexico, and roads are in that. So it's very important. And remember, when Gary Johnson, pork is good. When Gary Johnson was governor, there was at least one time when he vetoed all the capital outlay. And what happened was the next year they came back and they had twice the capital outlay. So
We're talking to Linda Siegel. So healthcare is still up in the air. Did anything in the arena of healthcare pass during this legislature?
Well, there were a number of bills. There was the governor's bill, which did not pass. And then Senator Dee Dee Feldman and Representative Dennis Picreau each had a healthcare bill. But one of the healthcare bills that did pass that didn't deal with insurance reform was one to limit the liability for healthcare providers in case of a federal emergency. And last year, the legislature passed a bill that when the state has an emergency and providers register with the Department of Health, then their liability is limited. Because of course, if a physician or a nurse or a physical therapist or something does work during an emergency and we don't have these kind of bills, if they were to get sued, then it's on them. So this is a good bill that in a federal emergency their liability is limited. And that did pass.
That's a fairly small
it's an innocuous
bill as healthcare bills
yes,
go.
Yes. It certainly wasn't dealing with the problem that we have with 400,000 New Mexicans essentially not having access to good and consistent health care because they don't have health insurance.
And so that is still up in the air, and maybe we will have an update on that in the coming weeks. Let's talk about crime.
Well, and again, here was a 30-day session, which is supposed to be about the budget, but a number of crime bills were on the governor's call. One of those was passed, which Ken Martinez, the representative from Gallup, carried, which would create new DWI penalties for a drunk driver who tampers with their interlock. And you may remember that a few years ago, Ken Martinez passed a bill that required all of us, all of our cars, to have interlock.
Every man, woman, and teenager.
Yes, that drive. And that I believe the governor vetoed that bill. But this is one for drunk drivers who tamper with their interlock. It creates new penalties. Another important bill, which people have been working on for about 3 years, is a human trafficking bill. And that finally passed this year. The Attorney General got on board with it, and Senator Mary Jane Garcia from Las Cruces carried this bill to make it a felony, shocking, to do human trafficking in New
Mexico. Is human trafficking like slavery?
Yeah, sort of, if you bring people.
So now it's a felony to be a slave trafficker, a slave trader.
Yeah, if you bring people into the state of New Mexico and you make them work for you for like sort of an indentured servant or something, or just bringing people across the border for whatever reason, undocumented, then this is a felony. And what they did also was put some money.
So we're talking about people who drive, if you were to drive an illegal immigrant from Mexico into New Mexico and you were caught, it's a felony?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
So that's what they're focusing on.
Yeah, that's the primary focus. And there is some money in the budget for victims of human trafficking to help those people that get brought over here.
And a little more, let's see.
Domestic violence.
Okay, domestic violence.
The governor put 3 or 4 domestic violence bills on his call, and one that passed was making a third time of domestic violence a felony. And that's something that they've been introducing for a couple of years, and that finally did pass.
And so that means that instead of getting treatment or therapy, the person goes to jail.
Yeah, and there still may be treatment with it, but when they've done it the third time, it's time for a little higher penalty and impact for their behavior.
And then there's a red light program. We've been hearing about red light programs in Albuquerque and Santa Fe.
Yes, and the legislature, last year the legislature asked the Albuquerque to lower the fines because there's pretty steep fines.
What are we talking about, this red light thing?
That's where there are these cameras on really high usage intersections. And the cameras take pictures of people who are running red lights and then they mail them a ticket for running that red light because they have proof, evidence right there. There's a picture, you ran that red light.
I'm surprised they haven't all been paintballed.
Well, in that way, in Albuquerque, the people who were running the red lights evidently were getting a little upset about all these tickets, and I think it escalates. If you get the second red light, then it goes up to 200 or or some very steep fine.
Uh-huh.
So the legislature asked Albuquerque last year to reduce the amount of the fine because they were so steep. And they said they would, but then they didn't. So this year, some legislators were really mad, and they came back, and they said that they passed this bill that said all the money from the red light fines go to the state and not the city of Albuquerque. We saw the next day after that happened, Mayor Martin Chavez said, okay, fine, I'm suspending the program, because he said the city would have to pay all the administrative costs and not get any of the money.
Mm.
But if you heard the news today, one of our city councilors is looking at, in Santa Fe, doing a red light program. So that'll be an interesting thing to watch in the future.
Any energy bills?
One of the energy bills that passed was to create financial incentives to like PNM or any of the other utility companies to use conservation techniques and to make energy delivery more efficient. And there was quite a debate about that on the floor of the Senate, that here we were giving benefits to utility companies for something they probably should do. And the whole idea behind it is to slow down the building of new public utilities, so that if we encourage them to do conservation, encourage them to encourage their subscribers to do conservation, that we wouldn't, you know, maybe that'll mean we won't have to build a new power plant for 2 more years or something.
Well, if everybody were to conserve energy, then their light and gas and electric bills would go down.
Yes.
Which means the PNM doesn't really, in terms of their bottom line, want them to be conserving energy. So it is a problem.
Yeah.
So now the money comes out of the taxpayers' pockets, or what happens?
Well, it comes out of the ratepayers' pockets. I mean,
so we're paying, how does that work? So we are paying more to encourage energy conservation so that we actually don't save money even when we conserve?
Well, not something like that, but not exactly.
Can somebody
cost more.
Please explain this to me? Radiocafe@ksfr.org is my email. I'm serious.
Okay. Let somebody explain that.
Elections,
yes. Well, remember last legislative session, somehow in the waning hours of the session, a bill went through that changed the way the pre-primary conventions work. And the pre-primary conventions are the parties, the Democrat-Republican parties, where they have their statewide office holders at the pre-primary convention. Those individuals who are running for those offices and for congressional offices in the federal Senate have to get 20% of the delegate votes. And if they don't get 20% of the delegate votes, before that law last year went into effect, they could go out and get X number of more thousand signatures, petition signatures from the citizens of New Mexico. And last year, a bill passed in the waning moments that did away with that and said, if you don't get the 20% of the delegates, you don't get to be on the ballot. And suddenly, we realized this year that, oh my gosh, we might have a problem, particularly here in our northern congressional district where we have 6 or 7 people running for Tom Udall's congressional seat.
Right.
And if they all go to the pre-primary convention and nobody gets 20%, the Democrats will not have
a candidate. We don't have a candidate. Oh, dear.
So this law takes it back to the way it was before.
Ah, so we Santa Fans like things the way they were before.
And that way, if you don't get the 20%, you can still go out and get thousands more people.
Let's talk about what did not pass.
Well, let me just tell you one more thing about the elections, because it's important for the community college.
Okay.
The Santa Fe Community College and the Santa Fe Public Schools, we got together, the boards, and said, how could we save money on elections? Because they do their election in February, we at the community college do ours in March. So we had Peter Wirth carry a bill that allows us, if we want to hold those two elections together and hopefully bring out more people to vote in those very low turnout elections.
Very low turnout indeed.
And save us a little money. So I just want to get that out.
Okay, good.
Okay.
So what did not pass? We do not have domestic partnerships again, ladies and gentlemen.
That's a really tough one, and we passed it out of the House again, and we're one vote short in a committee in the Senate. The Senate Judiciary Committee was tied. So that bill was not able to go to the floor of the Senate, where it was anticipated that there would be enough votes with the tiebreaker from the lieutenant governor. So, and it is a controversial bill. It is not marriage, but it provides some of the same benefits of marriage, but it would not be called marriage. It would be called domestic partnership. It's for people who are gay or straight. A lot of older people on Social Security or retirement would benefit from something like that, being able to get some of the same protections but not lose their federal benefits. So once again, that bill is dead.
And so education, there was this whole question of the new funding formula. That died as well?
Yes, and that was kind of tragic in that for the last 2 years, a task force has been working on analyzing, reviewing, looking at how we fund our education, how we fund the public schools in New Mexico. The state spent $1 million on this study. An outside group came in and helped us look at these numbers. And what it revealed was that we are underfunding our public schools in New Mexico to the tune of about 15%. And so this new funding formula really changed how we would fund the public schools, made it much simpler. Right now we have multiple factors that get added into every school district's budget, depending on just a whole lot of issues. And this new funding formula changed it down to like 7 factors, looking at high poverty, looking at English language learners, certainly a factor for special ed, and it really made it more concise and easier to deal with. And there was some controversy about it, and most of that got worked out within the legislative session with amendments on the bill. And one of the most important amendments was creating an accountability council that would look at how to make every public school accountable, because one of the things that changes is it just says, okay, public school, here's a pot of money, and you spend it however you want. If you want to have nurses, you can have nurses. You want to have counselors, if you don't want to have them, you don't have to. If you want to do PE, whatever.
And as we've discussed, that could be great or it could be
scary.
Just absolutely horrifying.
Yes. So this whole accountability task force is going to work on it. But what it would require is about $350 million new dollars into the public school system, going to the public education department. And there were some bills that would have created that. But the final amendment that they put on the Mimi Stewart's new funding formula bill was to say, until we get all the money in a separate fund, this will not go into effect. And that made people feel more secure that we weren't going to create a new funding formula and then not fund it. And what happened is it went through the House, it went through the Senate Education Committee, and then never got a hearing in the Senate Finance Committee.
Huh.
And so never had an opportunity to be voted on the floor of the Senate.
So this is something we'll be seeing next year during the 60-day session.
Absolutely. And people were very upset that they had done all this work and then the Senate didn't even hear it.
So we have that died. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Ethics bills. No new ethics in the New Mexico legislature.
No, the contribution limit bill didn't pass. The ethics commission didn't pass. Public financing for statewide offices didn't pass. So the legislators are very reluctant to, obviously, because we've been trying to do this for like 3 or 4, 5 years, pass any ethics legislation. So it didn't happen.
So the way it's happening right now is working for them.
Yes. And a lot of people feel like, well, you know, I'm an honest person. I don't need this. And most of our legislators are honest.
Taxes.
Well, here in Santa Fe, Senator Grubesek, this is the second year in a row, he introduced a bill to prevent cities from imposing a transfer tax on any real estate. I think the city council here had talked about doing a 1% on any real estate that sold for over $500,000. And this bill passed out of the Senate, but ended up dying in a House committee.
Very interesting. I know a town where they do that, and the transfer tax is used to buy conservation land.
Wow.
And it works out beautifully in this town that would otherwise be developed to the hilt.
Yeah, and in Santa Fe, we were talking about using it for affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't pass, so there's still that opportunity. One important bill that the governor really wanted was to allow, on the Rail Runner, to allow the four counties where the Rail Runner is going to be coming, which is Bernalillo, Sandoval, Valencia, and Santa Fe, allow us citizens to vote on whether we want a gross receipts tax to help fund the Rail Runner. And that bill didn't get out of the Senate either.
So, anything else that didn't pass of note?
Well, I think we were going to talk a little bit about the health care bill. The governor's health care bill, which was carried by Representative John Heaton from Carlsbad, was a very ambitious bill and probably was a little too ambitious for our revenues and for the legislators. So in the House, they amended that bill so that the House could support it. And that bill went over to the Senate and, again, died in the Senate Finance Committee. And that's the one that the governor says, look, I want health reform. I want some insurance reform in our state. And if I don't get it, I'm calling you back to special session. So we're just waiting to see when that special session will be, if it really is going to be, and then what can realistically come out of a health reform bill that requires universal health care insurance, universal insurance, in a time when the state's revenues are really down. In fact, we underfunded Medicaid this year, and that's one of the key components of getting a lot of low-income people onto health insurance is to expand Medicaid. And here we may be looking at a cut to provider rates or something in the next year because Medicaid is underfunded.
Well, Linda Siegel is KSFR's legislative correspondent, and this has been the legislative wrap-up. We'll probably be hearing a little more about the special session.
I think we'll be back soon.
We will be back soon. Linda Siegel, thank you so much, and hope you get at least a little mini vacation.
Yes, thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. Ciao.